Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellison. Thanks for listening to my podcast again, where I have conversations with educational leaders, researchers, innovators, people that I just find really interesting. And in this case, someone who I've kind of started following over Twitter and have just recently met, and that's Corey DeAngelis, who is a policy analyst at the Cato Center for Educational Freedom and policy advisor for the Heartland Institute. I found him really interesting because even in his bio, it says his research focuses on the effect of educational choice programs on student achievement and non-academic outcomes. And that's something that I want to eventually ask you about, Corey, is the non-academic outcome side of things, because we do place so much emphasis on test scores, test results. But just in this question and to start us out, you know, as a researcher, and when it comes to educational choice programs, and I've been following you a ton and watching the interaction back and forth on Twitter, what do we know, or what can we say we know about educational choice programs?
Yes, that's a broad question. I'll first start out just to, you know, lay out what I mean by educational choice programs. I mostly focus on private school choice programs. The most used word in the media is a voucher program, but there's other types of private school choice programs. But essentially, the most basic form is a voucher where, you know, in the current system, you're residentially assigned to some type of government school. The voucher allows kids to, you know, opt out of that residentially assigned school and go to a private school of their choice and take some of their public dollars to that school. So my research focuses on the effects of those types of programs on student outcomes. And, you know, like you said, you know, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people will say that the evidence on these types of programs is mixed. And I really think that that's false. And well, it actually is false if you look at the most rigorous evidence. I think that people say that the evidence is mixed when they just, you know, they hear positive things about school choice, they hear negative things about school choice, and they conclude that, well, the evidence must be mixed if they read positive and negative things. But when I focus on the research literature, I look at the most rigorous evidence, which is the experimental evaluations. And what I mean by experimental is, you know, like when you have a medical trial, the way that we know that medicine works is that researchers in the medical field randomly assign a pill to certain patients, which is whatever the medicine they're trying to look at. And then for the other patients, they randomly assign a sugar pill, what they call placebo. And if you compare the outcomes for the two groups, you can tell the effect of the medicine. Similarly, with school choice programs, if there's more people that want the program than there are spots available, they use random assignment, just like the medical trials, to determine who gets access to the program to get to a private school. And the losers of that lottery have to go to their residentially assigned government school. So just overall, the evidence, there's 17 of these experiments in the United States. 11 of them find statistically significant positive effects on student test scores. Only two find statistically significant negative effects out of the 17. Which one of the studies is in Louisiana, and one of them is actually right here in Washington, D.C. But the preponderance of the evidence is positive on test scores. And now I can go to a lot of other types of outcomes, like racial integration, civic outcomes, like tolerance and political participation. And those are much more positive than the test score effects. So if you want me to elaborate on any other types, you know, there's fiscal impacts, there's civic outcomes, there's graduation rate impacts, there's a whole lot of literature, and I'll just say real quickly that those effects are more positive than the test score effects.
So that's something that I was really interested in, because you've also been writing a little bit on, you know, that you know, with vouchers, the safer schools, or just even the paper that was I saw posted even this morning about the non-cognitive skills. Like, so when you talk about this, and when you write about this, and when you look at this, you're going bigger and more than just test scores, correct?
Oh, yes, definitely. For one reason, it's because, you know, people are kind of fed up with standardized testing. You know, schools are supposed to do a lot of other things, like shape someone's character, that isn't actually captured by a math or reading standardized test scores. That isn't to say that test scores don't have anything important at all that they capture. It just, they're not very good predictors of long-term outcomes like lifetime earnings or whether or not you end up in jail as an adult. So, you know, there's a growing body of evidence suggesting that if you look at the effects of school choice programs or other types of educational interventions, and you look at their effects on test scores, on, and you follow those same kids over time, a significant amount of those effects on test scores do not predict effects of those same programs for the same kids on their long-term outcomes, such as graduation or college enrollment.
And then one of the articles that, that you wrote, you pointed out too that, you know, especially I think it was 23 of 24 studies done on charter schools, where they did these studies and where they did this research, that the charter schools actually had a benefit and an impact on the traditional public school in the community as well.
Right. Right. So that number actually increased to 26 studies now. You're correct. It was 24 at one point. But it's 26 studies now, and 25 of 26 find statistically significant positive effects of these types of voucher programs on the kids left behind in public schools. So the kids that don't even choose to use a voucher program benefit through competitive pressures. Because, you know, when public schools start losing student enrollment, and since funding is tied to student enrollment, they start to have a stronger incentive to change their curriculum, to do whatever it takes to keep their customers, that is the families, within their schools. So, you know, a lot of people will argue, well, what about the kids that don't have motivated parents that are motivated enough to use these programs? They may be left behind in the schools and do worse. But this is the most clear evidence there is on the effects of private school choice programs, is that the kids left behind do a lot better. And so one of the reasons is competitive pressures. But another reason is that the kids don't have to even switch schools. So the kids get to stay in their school, benefit from competitive pressures, while the kids that use voucher programs take a negative test score hit initially because they switch to a new school. And research by people like Stanford economist Eric Kanishek has found that switching schools for whatever reason has a negative test score hit. So I think that could be part of the reason why the competitive effects studies are so positive.
So, Corey, you know, one of the things that, you know, you're going back and forth on. So as a researcher, maybe two things, but ask one question first, is what would you want to know, or what are you digging deep into here in the future as you want to say, hey, we know this, but we want to know more? Like, where are the areas where you're digging for future research?
Yeah, so obviously the things that are most interesting are the most difficult things to get data on. So when I first started my PhD program at the University of Arkansas, my first study was looking at the effects of the Milwaukee voucher program on kids' criminal activity by the time they were 23 to 25 years old. And so, you know, I was just lucky enough to have an advisor, Patrick Wolf, which is one of the biggest school choice researchers in the country. He had access to the state mandated evaluation data for the individual students. And so, you know, it's really hard to get these data because, you know, of obvious privacy reasons. So it's really difficult to be able to do these long-term evaluations using rigorous methods. You know, it's much more rigorous to be able to look at individual students instead of, you know, overall averages. But, you know, in that study, we found that kids that got at least 4 years of the program were about half as likely to commit crimes when they grew up to be about 23 to 25 years old. So I think that's the most interesting stuff. That's the only study that currently exists linking private school choice to crime. There are two other studies linking public school choice to crime, you know, through charter schools. And they find similarly large positive effects on reducing the likelihood that kids end up as criminals and adults. So, you know, one of the reasons that this may be is that schools of choice have a strong incentive to have a stronger school culture. You know, people aren't going to send their kids to a school that has gang activity going on all the time and, you know, other promiscuous activity going on in school. And if kids, you know, are in a school that has a strong school culture, they may grow up to be less likely to be involved with the criminal justice system. So I think there's only three studies that exist on that right now. I think that is very interesting to look to research more. But then also the school choice debate is moving from, you know, should we have school choice at all? What are the effects of school choice in general to what should school choice look like? You know, how regulated should it be? Should we require private schools to do everything that public schools do? So some of my most recent research looks at the effects, the unintended consequences of regulations on private schools.
And that's what I was going to ask you, because, a mentor of mine, Boston University, was Charlie Glenn, and he wrote a book called The Myth of the Common School. And in one of your recent articles, you wrote that Horace Mann had it all wrong, which is a great statement. Blasphemous for many, but in that kind of statement, and then in your recent comment about regulation, how much school choice, what kind of school choice, for parents, in those types of what are you seeing as developing as potential opportunities for greater choice here in the future, and then even maybe fuller choice down the road someplace.
Yeah, so with the regulation literature, you know, the obvious concern that most people have with voucher programs is that they argue that public funds are going to private schools, and that if that is the case, that the private schools should be held accountable by the public. And so people will say, I don't want my tax money going to unaccountable private schools, so we must strap them down with burdensome government regulations. And they want to make sure that, you know, disadvantaged families don't make bad decisions. And so that's their intention, and it might be a good intention. But the unintended consequence of that, of, you know, holding schools, quote unquote, accountable to standardized test scores or open admissions policies, it turns out that when you regulate the crap out of school choice programs, one of the effects is that the lower quality schools are more likely to participate. And this is because the schools that are most desperate for the voucher cash are the most likely to say, you know what, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get this money. And so what you have is this almost counterintuitive result that trying to control the quality of schools and control the decisions of parents actually leads to lower quality in the availability of options. Another thing that was found by Lindsay Burke and I is that voucher programs that are more highly regulated turn private schools essentially into public schools. And we use the private school universe survey to look at this in different voucher locations. And in the more heavily regulated programs, environments like in Louisiana, the schools started to be a lot less specialized over time after taking voucher money. So, if you're trying to provide new options, innovative options and specialized options for unique children, regulating school choice and making them look like the schools that they're trying to leave is a very bad idea, even if the intentions are good.
So what would be, I think you've written about this a little bit, about educational savings accounts, other options. Is that the best option then to allow schools to be distinctive, allow parents to have greater choice in this process? Or are there other methods to providing, opportunity for schools to, provide the education and culture and the meanings and the values that they desire without kind of reverting back into, what you just said about becoming more like the schools where people were trying to leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's one of the reasons why I've argued that education savings accounts are better than voucher programs because they're less likely to be regulated. So just to start off, an education savings account is similar to a voucher program, but instead of only being able to use those funds at a private school for tuition, the funds go into a savings account for the child, controlled by the family, obviously. And they can use those funds for any type of educational expenditure that has to be approved by the government. So you can't go around buying big screen TVs unless you want to go to jail. But you can use it on private school tuition and fees. You can use it for tutoring and textbook services. So a whole wide array of educational options. And it really takes advantage of the fact that education or schooling is just one channel to get to an education. So it really takes advantage of that fact. And then also it gives individual families an incentive to choose the lower price options in the market for schooling. So it gives them the incentive to economize because they can roll over funds from year to year if they don't use 100% of the funding. And they can even save it for college for their children if they still have money left over after 12th grade. So I think that's the best option going forward. These can be privately or publicly funded. They can come out of the public education budget, or they can be funded through a tax credit mechanism where you have corporations and individuals donating to organizations that then award out the education savings account funds to individual families. And, you know, these programs, there's only six of these programs that are education savings accounts in the U.S. right now. And one of the problems is that they're only targeted to a very small portion of the population for special needs individuals. And I think it would be better to make it available to everybody to make it, you know, a universal program, which is what some states have been trying to get passed pretty recently. And the reason for that is if you have a stronger demand for private schooling and private schooling options or educational options in a specific area, that gives an additional incentive for new providers to enter the market. So I think it would be a really good idea to expand the current programs that we actually have and really keep pushing for education savings accounts rather than voucher programs. And, you know, this is the best policy we have currently, but there are different types that you can kind of think up in your mind that aren't actually available yet. And one was thought up by Andrew Coulson, which was, he was previously the director of education at Cato Institute. He recently passed away, which is unfortunate because he's a very brilliant mind. But his idea was to have you know, everybody has to donate to education through, you know, what currently we have a certain percentage of property taxes that go to education. But his idea was let everybody have that certain percentage that they need to donate, but allow them to either choose to give it to the government, which would be the default option for government schools, or let them, you know, donate that money to some other type of entity that awards scholarships to go to either private or public schools. And that would create an incentive for efficient spending in education overall in the United States. So I think that's the best option if we really want a diversity of options and, you know, a very efficient education system. But I do not know of any individual states that have actually tried that yet.
It seems like that would be a huge undertaking and then a huge just conceptual framework shift for people away from just what's been traditionally the property tax to the local kind of sense. Mm-hmm. And to be, it would be interesting to change how people think about sometimes where their tax money or this, if you use that mm-hmm. term donation, where that actually goes to and see what decisions people would actually make with that money.
Yeah, and, you know, I think people are okay. I think people kind of understand that government typically doesn't spend money efficiently for a whole variety of different reasons. But I think people are kind of okay with giving some money towards education through the tax system because they kind of understand that there's no opting out of it. You don't have any choice. You don't have an option to to, you know, divert these funds to a private entity that could spend the money more efficiently. But I think if you gave people that opportunity, they'd start to at least think a lot more about, hey, is the government spending my money efficiently? Where else could these resources be allocated? So I do think there would be a shift. It wouldn't be immediate, even if, you know, tomorrow this type of policy was passed. But I think people would at least start thinking about it. And, you know, it might be that people still, for a long time, just took the default option and, you know, donated their funds to the government. But at least they'd start thinking about it. And at least they'd have some other type of opportunity and give the government an incentive to have a stronger, to allocate resources more efficiently.
So let me take you and kind of wrap up in some ways. You've been going back and forth with some big hitters in the education policy world, and it's been interesting to watch. And what's the fear for change? What is the inhibitor that you're seeing or in those conversations when you go back and forth with people or even at different events that you're at or when you speak to people who may not necessarily agree with greater school choice and are the traditional kind of public education people, what are you learning when you go back and forth with these people and what are they so afraid of in if we identify those things that make them nervous for the larger picture?
Well, there's a couple reasons for that. One is that people just generally don't like change all that much. And, you know, we've all grown up in this system where everybody goes to public schools or everybody just is forced to pay for the public schools. And if you want to go to a different school, you have to pay twice, essentially. You have to pay for two schools if you want to go to a private school. And everybody kind of thinks that since that's how it's always been, that's how it needs to be. And you have to start getting people to imagine how different types of systems could work. And, you know, a lot of what I try to talk about is just, you know, imagine you were residentially assigned to stuff like restaurants, you know, that you would think that that was ridiculous. And then, so then we get into the conversation of why education might be a little different than restaurants. But I essentially default to the idea that restaurants and education are both pretty similar because they're both services. The only difference is that we're forced to go to a specific school that essentially has monopoly power over all the customers. So that's not a good idea, just like it wouldn't be a good idea for restaurants. So one thing is that people don't like change. But another thing is, you know, there's a lot of stuff going around in the media just saying things that are just absolutely false, like the evidence is mixed on school choice, or you have people from other places saying that the evidence is negative on school choice, and that couldn't be further from the truth. But, you know, since people see all these negative things in the media, they think that school choice is actually having negative effects on students when it's actually not. So I'm constantly trying to show people, look, these are all the studies. I don't cherry pick anything. I just show people tables of all the studies. And just show, like, look, it's overwhelmingly in favor of school choice. So if you care about what the evidence says, it's really important to understand that these blog posts or these opinion pieces by other people are just false. So that's one way I try to convince people that those blog posts are wrong. Just show them all the evidence. But then, you know, you have a lot of people that have a vested interest in protecting the status quo. A lot of people talk about, well, you're stealing money or you're diverting funds from the public schools. But then I respond that, well, the public schools will only lose any money at all if they lose students. If students voluntarily select to go to a school that they think is better for them. And, you know, all these voucher programs are set up in a way that the money spent for the voucher is less than the per pupil funding amount in public school. So what happens is, in most cases, when students leave public schools to go to private schools, they only take 70 to 80% of the funding with them. And so the public schools actually get a lot of the money that, about 20% of funds. And so they essentially end up, you know, they have less funds overall, but they have more funds per pupil left behind in the public school. And, you know, just think about any other business. Like, if you left Walmart and they wanted to keep your money, you would think that was a bad idea. And Walmart would probably be really happy if they got to keep 20% of your funds when you left Walmart to go to a different type of store. I think the district schools should actually be very happy about school choice because they still get to keep some of the money. So there's a lot of various reasons for why this has been very difficult to convince people that school choice is a good idea. But a lot of people are starting to understand that it is a good idea. And I think, you know, while DeVos may have been has had some bad interviews, at least her being appointed to Secretary of Education has got people to start talking more about school choice. You know, before she was appointed, a lot of people didn't even know what school choice was. You know, so I think people are starting to understand that this is a no-brainer, that we should not be residentially assigned to schools that have monopoly power over us.
Corey, I'll leave it there because that's a great last line and that's a great summation, you know, of this, you know, situation. And, you know, I've kind of been following this or been part of this for about 15 years now. And it's interesting to begin to watch it unfold and what you're doing and your work and bringing the research together and putting it in a place like Twitter where people can use it and read it and make sense of it. I think it's hugely helpful and insightful. So thanks for spending time with me today and keep up the great work.
All right. Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me.